Well, 7 o'clock, yeah. All the particulars are on those flyers. So, back to work. continuing with our study of the materials from the Pali Canon. So Jeff told me that in the last 2 weeks, 1 week you discussed the Turning the Wheel of the Law Sutra, which is supposed to be the first teaching that the Buddha gave after his awakening. So that's a sutra that I hope you'll remember and read many times again. And also, in the following week, he talked a little bit about, and you might have read, the Kalama Sutra, which is also a really important sutra that's often referred to. That's the famous one where the Buddha says, don't believe something you hear just because it makes sense, or just because it's reasonable, or just because it's said by an impressive teacher, or it's traditional. You have to verify everything by your own direct experience. Very famous sutra where the Buddha gives that teaching. So I hope you'll study that one too, many times. And I know that after that discussion, after that talk last week, all those sutras which are about spiritual teachers and how you judge a spiritual teacher and figure out what's a good one and not a good one, that there was a long discussion about faith and spiritual teachers and teachers who mess up and so forth. So John Murray sent me I could listen to it on my computer, but I haven't done it yet, so I hope to be able to do that. But it is important in this chapter, Bhikkhu Bodhi's chapter on approaching the Dharma, that he talks about teachers, because it's noteworthy that in all the traditions of Buddhism that teach meditation practice and transformation, all of them tell us that teachers are an important factor. And how we can make good and proper use of a teacher is a pretty important topic for us to be clear on. And I suppose that we're not entirely clear on this yet, but we're working on it, because the whole institution, if that's what you would call it, of teachers and students is something that is embedded in a culture. And the way that teachers and students are embedded in Asian cultures from which we receive Buddhism is not the same cultural matrix. So it's going to take us a long time to learn how to do this together. And so it's no wonder that we've had a lot of false starts. And there are many, many more ways to go wrong than right. In a way, we can be grateful for all the variety of mistakes that we've seen so far, because they really are instructive. You know, they tell you. I mean, I certainly have learned a lot from what I've seen. Ways to go wrong. And let's not repeat that, you know. So, it's not so easy to learn from something without being so scarred by it that you lose your ability to see what happened in the past clearly. It's not that easy to do. So the text in this chapter, I think, can be helpful in this reflection. And it would be nice if we could just say, you know, it's all in the text. All we have to do is see what it says there and just do that, and that's all there is to it. I'm afraid that the text won't entirely answer all our questions. Anyway, written texts never do. That's one thing that you can count on when it comes to written texts. They will never answer all your questions, because every written text must be subject to and even require interpretation. And no interpretation can ever be final, nor can it be all-inclusive, covering every case. So, in the end, we hope for all kinds of guidance from our friends, from texts, from teachings. And we trust time and collective wisdom to bring things eventually to the right conclusions. But in the end, it's up to us, each one of us, to make our own determinations to the best of our ability as it is now. But definitely to reflect on the teachings and hear them is a good help for us. So Jeff told me that the last text in the chapter, the fifth one, he didn't discuss. So this is an excerpt from the Kanki Sutra in the Majjhima Nikaya. And Bhikkhu Bodhi gives it the title of Steps Toward the Realization of Truth. So that seems like an important thing to talk about. So I'd like to just touch on that tonight. So maybe some of you read it. This is page 90. Yeah, that starts on 96. So in this sutta, the Buddha is talking to a young, we're told, he's 16 years old, young but very smart and talented Brahmin. And he wants to know, how can we verify truth? Because as a Brahmin, he's received these ancient holy texts, and he's been told that these texts are absolute truth, and he's memorized them, and he's quite expert on them, but he wants to know, how would he know if these texts are really true or not, or if anything is really true or not? Now, as I mentioned a minute ago, in the Kalama Sutra, and in many other places, the Buddha says, well, the way you verify truth is by relying on your own experience, not on tradition, not on reasoning, not on the reputation of the teacher, but on your own experience, knowing for yourself directly. But if you read Bhikkhu Bodhi's introduction to this section, he points out that this is not as simple as it sounds at first, because clearly the deepest possible human truth, if we believe that the Buddha taught, it was one version, gave us one version of the deepest possible human truths, so obviously we might not be able to know those truths in the beginning by our direct experience. In other words, the truths that we're seeking are deeper truths than we are capable of seeing at this time in the beginning of our practice. And if we could see them right now, why would we need to, study for a whole lifetime in order to see them? So we're all capable of seeing these deep truths. Of course, it might take us a while to sort of sort out what do we mean by seeing, and what do we mean by truth, but never mind about that for the moment. Let's just leave it at that I think we're all capable of seeing, knowing these real truths, these deep truths, but I think we don't have to be geniuses to realize that not right away. It's going to take time, it's going to take effort in our living, in our reflection, in our practice. So that means that in the beginning, we have to trust ourselves to follow what seems true to us according to our experience now, according to what just makes sense to us. Without a leap of faith or trust in somebody else, and then following that way that seems to make sense to us over time, we will, we hope, and we could expect, I think, understand more deeply and more fully. And when we understand more deeply and more fully, we will trust more deeply and more fully, which will help us to understand more deeply and fully. So in the text, the Buddha makes this, what I think is just a beautiful distinction between what he calls, what Bhikkhu Bodhi, in his beautiful translation of these words, whatever they mean in Pali, Bhikkhu Bodhi renders them as the preservation of truth and the discovery of truth. So these are two different things, the preservation of truth and the discovery of truth. So the first one, the preservation of truth. If we have faith in something, or believe so far in our experience, as far as it goes, that something is true, and we say about that thing, this is my faith, or this is what seems to me so far to be true. If we understand it that way, then this is the preservation of truth. In other words, we're being humble. We're recognizing our limitation. Not you know, cosmetically humble, but really humble. We really honestly know. This is, I have faith in this, I think, really believe this is true, but maybe it's not. But I believe it. This is my belief. This is my faith. This is my understanding. Not, this is absolutely so, but this is what I understand to be so. And I think this is really great, you know. We should always have this attitude. No matter how much we come to see and understand, and how wise we ever become, we should always preserve the truth in this way. Because, as Suzuki Roshi teaches us, something may be so as far as we know, but not always. It may not always be so. I was talking to somebody the other day who studied with a Korean Zen master who always told him, don't ever get comfortable in your practice. Don't ever think you know. And this is really the spirit of our practice too. What we're trying to do in our practice is to try to understand. We're not trying to understand. We're just trying to understand. Do you see what I mean? So we might, through that effort, understand something. And I hope that, and I don't, more than hope, I know that all of us have some wisdom and have understood much already in our practice. But whatever wisdom we have, we should try to understand further. And we should be willing to be surprised and to give up the wisdom we have when it turns out not to be the wisdom that's needed now. So to keep on trying to understand doesn't mean that we should feel disappointed that we don't understand, or think that someone else understands, or even to imagine that there's something to understand. If you look at it like that, then the effort to keep on trying to understand rapidly becomes very grim. And if you think that people seem grim in most of the Zen centers, this is the reason why. Because they're desperately trying to understand something. They think that someone understands. They think that they don't yet understand. And this is a very grim way of life. It's a path of despair and self-doubt. And this is what would happen only if we were expecting some sort of shining final truth, which would be some sort of escape from the problem of our life. So the effort to keep on trying to understand and keep on trying to understand and keep on trying to understand is, I hope, a joyful and engaging effort. Because we're always learning something new. And that's really, when you think about it, it's the most fun thing of all, isn't it? To learn something new that you never knew before. It's amazing. And you're amazed continually. So the effort to try to understand, if you hold that in the right way, is beautiful. And in this effort, we would always preserve truth. And we would always say, without any arrogance or any embarrassment, this is what I understand so far. This is what I have faith in so far. Now, if you think about that for a little while, this emphasis on experience and always new experience, it kind of makes you wonder about the nature of religious experience itself. And the reason I've been thinking about this is because I know I'm good friends with two Buddhist scholars. One lives out here and the other one is at Brown at Providence, Rhode Island. Hal Roth, Professor Roth. And he and I were spending time together this last week. And he and the other professor have a totally different and quite confrontative difference in understanding the nature of religious experience. And the question is there such a thing as religious experience? Is there some kind of absolute experience outside of any conditioning or structure? Now, most religious people would say, of course there is. Maybe even the Buddha of the Pali canon would say, of course there is. But a lot of critical religious scholarship nowadays denies this. Now, I myself have noticed the very odd fact, maybe you've noticed this too, because I've been going around for a long time to different spiritual places, you know. And it's an odd fact, but true, that if you go to a Rinzai Zen place, the students will have Rinzai Zen religious experiences. And if you go to a Catholic monastery, they will have Catholic religious experiences. Tibetan Buddhists have Tibetan enlightenment experiences. And we poor Soto Zenists well, that's good. Yeah, I was going to say what it says here anyway. But that's true. But what it says here is fuzzy. fuzzy sorts of enlightenment experiences that don't amount to too much. And that's our particular bias. If you go to a place where the master is a Kundalini yogi, everybody will shake and shimmer with Kundalini energy, which you would never see, or very, very rarely see in a Zen place. They don't do that. Although some Christians do it, never Catholics, but evangelicals do it. Have you ever noticed this? Yet all these different groups claim that the experiences that they are having are not in any way conditioned by their systems, but are unmediated, absolute religious experiences. And that the experiences of all the other guys are not. So this makes me think that all religious experiences are shaped by our ideas and our context. Now, the critical religious scholars think that that being so, there is no such thing as religious experience, or religious experience is invalid. But I don't think it means that religious experience is invalid. I just think it means that we have to be realistic and modest in our claims. Personally, I don't have any doubt that our practice is true and real, because I can see that in my own life, and especially I can see it in your life. Also, when I study the teachings, they really seem true to me, as far as my understanding at present goes. And for me, that's enough. If someone should come along and prove that I'm totally deluded in this, that we're all practicing some completely delusionary teaching, that wouldn't change much, you know, for me. That wouldn't make that much difference. Even if I said, yeah, gee, you're right, you know. It wouldn't really make that much difference. And, you know, what's the difference, really, between delusion and truth? Anyway, you know? I mean, are we that clear about it? I mean, maybe these things are really, you know, kind of just... we all know, one thing we know, truth we like, delusion we want to get away from. But other than that, you know, what is really the difference? I would never try to convince anybody that our practice is not delusionary. But I would say that whether it's delusionary or not, it is our practice. And it gives us some peace and comfort. And it gives us a way to live in the world and a way to view the world that really helps us. So of that, there's no doubt. Maybe it's a big delusion, but so what? Anyway, in my case, I've been doing it so long that there's no hope to change now, you know, so it wouldn't really, wouldn't really matter. Some of you who are just starting, think about it, you know. Yeah. So I'm not at all, I wouldn't, you know, try to make a case for the truth of our practice. Especially, I wouldn't try to make a case that our practice is the best practice. I certainly wouldn't do that. But it's for sure that our practice is ours. It is what we do. And we do want to continue with it. Now, this reminds me of a little talk that the other place that I was visiting while I was gone was I was in the Zen teachers meeting in upstate New York, and attending the meeting, it was an American Zen teachers, but Akiba Roshi, the Japanese Soto Zen bishop of North America, came to the meeting. And he gave a really interesting talk, which moved me a lot. Akiba, you don't know him maybe, but you know his wife, because her name is Yoshi. And she owns Yoshi's, the famous jazz place in Oakland, which has the best jazz that you can ever hear. So he's a really wonderful person. He's very simple and humble. You know, you're not at all an impressive person with a big spiritual glow, you know. You hardly notice him if he was in a room. So he gave us a talk that I really love. Maybe I already told you about this. I know I told some of you, but I want to repeat it anyway. First, he started by saying that he trained for many, many years in Japan. And you know, the truth is that the monks train really hard in Japan. He said he trained so hard for so many years that all of his teeth fell out. And he nearly died of malnutrition because they don't sleep that much. They work their tails off in meditation and in also physical work, and they eat really poorly. No exercise other than work, you know. So it was really tough. He really had a tough time. So after his training was over, he would go around and he realized that now he was arrogant. You know, because he would see other people and say, these people don't know anything. They've not been through what I've been through. You know, how can they talk about Dharma? And he realized, you know, I'm totally arrogant. All this hard training and all it did is it made me arrogant. I lost my teeth, I nearly died, and now I'm arrogant. And then he said, but that made him realize how deluded he was. And it made him see that after all that, he was still deluded, and so was everybody else. That human beings are always confused and deluded, and that's just the way it is. All his tough work for all those years on the cushion did not touch his human delusion one bit, because it is just our birthright to be that way. So he said, to appreciate this and realize this truth and see how deep and how tragic this is called enlightenment. To really see that and understand it and not be hoping for something else, that's enlightenment. And this is what Dogen says too. To be deluded throughout delusion is enlightenment, Dogen says. So what we usually call enlightenment is a part of this, but it's only a part. But then Akiba said something really wonderful after that. He said, when you continue, knowing this, when you continue to practice over and over again, some wisdom rises up in you. And that wisdom mixes through and through with your human delusion till you can't tease them apart. And then that mixture of delusion and enlightenment gives rise to what Ajo McMullen, the translator, because Akiba doesn't speak English, called the wonderful self. The wonderful self is produced from this. And he said, and the wonderful self is the source of all human warmth. So this, to me, this was such a great and beautiful teaching. Warmth. Warmth, yeah. So this is such a beautiful teaching, you know? And delivered by Akiva in such a sweet and unassuming way. So anyway, in this text, the Buddha is talking about the preservation of truth. And also he's talking about the discovery of truth. So that's the other one, the discovery of truth, which literally the Pali means to awaken to the truth. And it seems as if awakening to the truth or discovering the truth is a more direct experience of the truth than preserving the truth. So I'll read you what the Buddha says about discovering the truth. So I'm reading on page 99. Number 17, paragraph 17. So the Brahmin Bharadvaja had asked, what is the discovery of truth? So the Buddha says, so a monk may be living in dependence on some village or town. Then a householder or a householder's son or daughter goes to him and investigates the monk, in other words, the potential teacher, investigates him in regard to three kinds of states. In regard to states based on greed, in regard to states based on hate, and in regard to states based on delusion. And the person asks himself, I guess, he thinks to himself, are there in this monk any states based on greed, such that, with his mind obsessed by those states, while not knowing, he might say, I know. Or, while not seeing, he might say, I see. Or he might urge others to act in a way that would lead to their harm and suffering for a long time. So he investigates, he watches the monk, and he sees if there is such a kind of states arising in him from greed. And then if he didn't see any, he would know. He would say, there are no such states based on greed in this monk. The bodily and verbal behavior of this monk are not those of one affected by greed. And the Dharma that he teaches is profound, hard to see and hard to understand, peaceful and sublime, unattainable by mere reasoning, subtle and to be experienced by the wise. This Dharma cannot easily be taught by one affected by greed. So in other words, he looks and observes the conduct and the speech of the person and concludes, as far as he can see, no. And then the same formula is repeated for hatred or antipathy and also delusion. And in each case, the person who's examining says, no, it looks to me like this monk is not acting or speaking in a way that shows that he's caught by greed, hate, or delusion.
It says a lot for the layperson, doesn't it?
Yeah. You know, well, it assumes that can be done.
Yeah.
You know, that the layperson, just the understanding is that the layperson is not all wise, you know, because he's seeking, you know, to study. And yet, despite that, he has enough, in other words, any of us can see, you know, and look and see and make that determination, yeah. So, then in paragraph number 20. So that's the first thing that happens. In other words, the discovery of truth. How do you discover truth? The first thing that happens is you have to find a good teacher, and you have to investigate that teacher and see for yourself that the teacher stands up to the scrutiny. When he has investigated him and has seen that he is purified from states based on delusion, after, you know, seeing that he's purified from states based on greed and hatred, then he places faith in him. Filled with faith, he visits him and pays respects to him. Having paid respect to him, he gives ear. In other words, he listens to the teachings. And when he gives ear, he hears the Dharma. Having heard the Dharma, he memorizes it and examines the meaning of the teaching he has memorized. When he examines their meaning, he accepts those teachings as a result of pondering them. When he has accepted those teachings as a result of pondering them, desire springs up. When desire has sprung up, he applies his will. Having applied his will, he scrutinizes. Having scrutinized, he strives. Resolutely striving, he realizes with the body, the supreme truth, and sees it by penetrating it with wisdom. In this way, Bharadvaja, there is a discovery of truth. In this way, one discovers truth. In this way, we describe this discovery of truth. There's one more part I want to get to. I'll skip and get back to later. Yeah?
Talk a little bit more about delusion. We were talking about truth and delusion before, and then how do you tell delusion? What do they mean when they say delusion?
Yeah. You're right. This is using delusion in a different way. I was using the word delusion in a more kind of absolute way. And here, it basically means, does the person have sufficient intelligence not to be befuddled and confused and saying things that don't make sense or don't add up or are not useful? So it's kind of a more relative use of the word delusion here. But I want to. There's a lot in that paragraph, you know, and also, it's Bhikkhu Bodhi is using words to translate Pali words, which aren't the words that he's using. So you know, what is really being said? In other words, so I'll give you my interpretation of that lengthy paragraph, because it actually is setting forth various steps and stages, right? So what's being said is that first of all, you have to find a good teacher. And then it's saying, and you have to take the responsibility to check that teacher out. And that can take a while. You know, you shouldn't just assume that the teacher knows what he or she is talking about. You have to really pay attention to his conduct and see whether the teacher is reliable. And that means over time, not just today or next week, but over a period of time. It takes a long time, actually, to feel that someone is reliable, because you know you have to observe them in different kinds of situations and over some time. You have to see whether it looks like to you that the teacher is motivated subtly, because probably not grossly. He wouldn't get away with being a teacher if the motivation was like grossly greed, hate, and delusion. Well, sometimes, you never know. Sometimes powerful teachers have, you know, very gross manifestations of greed, hate, and delusion. But usually it's subtle. So you have to pay attention. And as Martha raises the question, how do we really know? And that's what often happens. You say, well, you know, somebody says, well, I can't really know. So maybe it looked to me like that was some kind of really shoddy conduct there, but who am I to judge the great guru's, you know, behavior? Maybe there was something hidden teaching in that or something like that. You know, people say these things, right? So, I mean, yes, I guess you could say that we never know for sure about anybody's conduct, whether a spiritual teacher or not. Yet, at the same time, we do see the teacher in operation as a human being. And we do get a feeling after a while. And we have to trust our gut, you know. This person is a reliable person, trustworthy human being, or not. Now, I think that if a teacher implicitly, or sometimes explicitly, or sometimes implicitly, makes large claims, to me, this would not be such a good thing. Because I think that modest teachers are more reliable than immodest ones. But then again, that just may be my bias. On the other hand, modest or not, teachers do have to actually be teachers. There's a place in the mandala for a teacher, and the teacher actually has to take that place. As Akiba says, it is probably a safe assumption that any human being has some delusions and attachments. In other words, everybody has some human character and conditioning. So we ought to look for this in our teachers, and we ought to make sure that they understand this as well as we do. In other words, that they themselves are aware of their shortcomings and their character flaws, and that they don't ignore them nor celebrate them too much. Because some teachers flaunt their character flaws and make them into teachings, you know. So, in other words, it may be that it's that we can't ever be entirely confident in our judgments here, but the text implies two really important things here. First, you have to take the responsibility to investigate. And second, whether you're entirely right or not, you have to be the one to decide whether or not the teacher passes the test. That's you. That's your job. You have to decide that. In other words, you can't trust somebody else's judgment, or you can't just say, well, it looks this way to me, but what do I know? No, you have to go with your own judgment. It's really up to you. Even though the teacher may be a great Buddha and you may just be an ordinary person, when it comes to investigating the teacher, you are the authority for yourself. Who else could be the authority? So you are the boss in that case. But once you decide that the teacher is a good teacher for you, then, as it says here, you have to put your faith in the teacher. You have to let the teacher, more or less, be the boss. Otherwise, how could you learn if you didn't put your faith in the teacher and you're always, you know, wondering about it? Then you really couldn't learn. But letting the teacher be the boss might include, I would say, it does include, disagreeing with the teacher sometimes, or even arguing or refusing to do something that you're asked to do. That the teacher might still be, you might still be having faith in the teacher and giving the teacher bosshood in those conditions. In the end, if it's not possible for you to let the teacher be the boss, then you should find another teacher. Or maybe no teacher. That doesn't mean you can't hang around, you know, and go to the different teachings, but there's a limit to what can be done. Sometimes the teacher might be reliable, but then later on not. And then you have to investigate again in the new situation and again determine what's right to do and do something about that. So the point here is that you have to take your own responsibility. Now the teacher has a big responsibility too. Not that the teacher has none. But when it comes to your practice, you're the one who's responsible. The teacher can never be responsible for your practice. So then, in other words, you find the teacher, you investigate, you put faith in the teacher, you visit the teacher, you have to show up, in other words. You have to pay attention, listen. It says memorize. It's not part of our practice, memorizing. But you have to ponder and reflect on the teachings. And then it says, desire springs up. And then it says, you apply will, you scrutinize, you strive. And finally it says, and you realize with the body the supreme truth and see it by penetrating it with wisdom. So what does all this amount to? So, as I say, you check out the teacher, you take responsibility for that. You take responsibility for letting the teacher be the boss, placing faith in the teacher. Because the magic of the practice Because we're not learning, you know, some like physics or some objective skill here. So the magic ingredient that we need for transformation is trust. Trust is magical. And if we're always only critical and mistrustful, that's why, you know, it doesn't work, because without that magical trust, transformation can't take place. So given that, you show up, you take in what's being taught, and you ponder it. You evaluate it for yourself. You verify it for yourself. You make it your own. You find your own way into it. You know, that's why we, you know, always, I'm always asking you, how do you see this? And then we talk to one another about that, because until you make it your own, it's not the teaching, you know. If you're just repeating what somebody else said or imitating the teacher, you're not really making it your own. So you have to verify it for yourself. Now, if you find a teacher that insists too much that your understanding should be the same as the teacher's understanding, and always trying to get you to conform to the teacher's understanding, be suspicious. I don't think that's so good. I think that's a problem. To me, it is a requirement. It's a job requirement. If they put it, you know, an ad in the paper, you know, Zen Master Wanted, one of the things it should say is, be able to see another's understanding. Don't always knock down another person's understanding because it's not yours. That's an act of imagination, right? To be able to see another person's, the profundity in another person's understanding. That's a job requirement, I think. So you have your own understanding. And when you have that understanding, desire arises. Because now you really see that there's something here to be done. And you have an enthusiasm and a zest to actually want to do the practice and take it deeper, to see it more clearly and more thoroughly. And then you really want to practice. You don't find yourself dragging your butt, you know, to practice. You want to do it. You find it delightful, because you want to make the effort to really solidify and strengthen this understanding that you're beginning to realize. And this effort and this striving will bring forth what is called here in the text, the discovery of truth. You realize your own teaching, and I think it's very important here that it says, with the body. It's kind of surprising in a way. Not to me, but it is, don't you think? At first, you think, gee, with the body. And you penetrate it with wisdom. So the understanding that we have is a good thing, but it's not nearly enough. And this point is so much emphasized in our particular tradition. I was just talking to an old friend who was a colleague at Zen Center many years ago, and left in the early 80s. A few of you in the room will know John Bales. I was talking to him when I was back there. And John's been practicing lately, after not doing any formal practice for maybe 25 years. He's been doing Vajrayana Buddhism, and he really enjoys it, and he thinks it's really great. But he said they have this wonderful understanding and this brilliant curriculum and classes and courses, and they really understand the Dharma. It's so beautiful, and the teachings are so marvelous in Tibetan Buddhism. But he said, but I don't think it's enough in their body. So he has this, he's on this mission, you know, to sort of introduce more Zen sitting and forms into this Tibetan tradition that he's in, so as to make it be an understanding of the body. And I don't know how successful he'll be in reforming the Shambhalas, but it's something that he, for him, is really true. I mean, it's something that he sees and experiences, because he practiced for 10 years in our way of practice. And when you practice for a long time in this way of practice, you really see how much practice is practice of the body. We have an understanding, a knowing that's deeper than the mind, deeper than the perceptions, deeper even than the heart or the emotions. That doesn't mean that the mind and the perceptions and the heart and the emotion is not important. It just means that that knowing in those ways goes all the way through to the body, so that it pervades our whole living, our whole mind, our whole heart, so that we find some sense of ease and joy and some love just in living our life. In other words, there's no special Dharma place or special Dharma practice. Wherever we are in our body, that's where the practice is. That's where the truth is. In every daily act, in whatever form our life takes. And for us, you know, especially in the everyday Zen way of practice, we really honor that. You know, whatever our job is, whatever work we're doing, whatever our relationships are, when we speak to someone, when we listen to someone, when we pick up a tool, you know, we understand that we're practicing the truth. So in the end, the Buddha's teaching, we understand, is not something external to us. And it's not something that the teacher presents that we're supposed to master and conform to. Buddha's wisdom is when we enter fully into our own living through our own breath and our own body and through our daily acts, including our speaking and our feeling. And this is really the kind of practice that we emphasize in Soto Zen. Just sitting, just standing, just walking, just bowing, just chanting, and so on. So this is a very appropriate place to end up, since we're going into session next week, and incidentally there won't be a meeting of the seminar next week. No substitutes, nobody's here. If you come, you'll just have to give your own talk, or not, because we won't be here. We'll all be in, not all of us, but many of us will be in session, so we won't have a meeting. But this, what I'm just talking about, is really the point of session. We're not going to meditate exactly. We're not going to session so that we can calm the body and mind, or so that we can have a big enlightenment experience, though it would be a great thing if we did calm the body and mind, have a little peace. It would even be better if we had a big enlightenment experience. But this really is not the point. If these things happen, they're only incidental. The point is to realize the supreme truth with our own body and to penetrate it with our wisdom, so that, as our vow says, Buddha's way is unsurpassable and we will become it. We will become it. So, one last thing. After the Buddha says all this, he says, and this is not yet the final discovery of truth. This is the beginning, but it's not final. So then the Brahmin says, well, what would be the final arrival at truth? And the Buddha says, at the end of paragraph 21, the final arrival at truth lies in the repetition, development, and cultivation of those same things. And in this way, there is final arrival at truth. In this way, one finally arrives at truth. In this way, we describe the final arrival at truth. So in other words, the final arrival at truth is not some other place or some other thing. It is just the repetition, the ongoing practice, the ongoing cultivation, the ongoing development of that which we realize with our bodies. So, we could say, you know, I don't know if we have any religious experience or what the truth status is of religious experience, but we know that we touch the truth with our body. We don't know the truth, we just touch the truth with our body. And maybe there isn't even any truth, but that hardly matters, because we know through our practice that we are touching something essential to our human life with the body. And we feel our whole body suffused with wisdom. And we know how much difference this makes in the poignancy of our living. And it's not final. And the way we make it final is to realize that there is no final. We keep on practicing. We repeat and we repeat. We develop and we develop. We cultivate and we cultivate. Not newer and deeper things and higher teachings and this and that, but just over and over again the same thing as it becomes more and more malleable and pliant and beautiful. The final truth may be the recognition that truth, or whatever we call it, simply goes on and on and on without boundary in time or space. So,